We're going to open up the Senate Committee on Business Consumers Affairs, Senate Bill 1115. We're going to carry that over. A little controversy. To Monday, a little controversy involving that bill. We did not have a full contingent of committee members, and so we will be carrying that over. For any members of the audience who are here for that bill, we will not be hearing that today. We'll hear it on Monday. So we'll open up a work session on Senate Bill 398.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, in the pile of information in front of you, you have a almost final staff member summary, which is intended as a convenient tool for us to review a brief history of this bill. I would call your attention to the effect of committee amendment section for that particular SMS. As you remember, the committee heard this bill on March 8th and passed the bill out of committee on April 9th. It went through four discussion and was sent back to the committee for further deliberation. And during that period, a number of modifications were made to the bill, which is reflected in the Dash 2 amendment in among the pile of paperwork in front of you. And just to refresh your memory, the amendments that we are talking about would make the following changes to this bill. There were some concerns raised about the provision of allowing services to occur and payments to be made on contracts before legal sufficiency review was complete. There is a change, a modification made to that provision. There were further concerns related to agency accountability. And you can see that the amendment further addressed those aspects as well. And finally, there were some concerns about ratification of contracts which have commenced prior to legal sufficiency review is complete. And this amendment also speaks to clarification and provisions under those circumstances. And I think since this bill has received quite a bit of attention of this committee, as well as members on the floor, we do have representatives here from the Department of Justice, and I think it will be perhaps helpful for members of the committee to hear a more detailed explanation from Marty Sethoff and anybody else from DOJ.
Cam Brady, you want to come up here? Marty, is anybody else up here? You think we should come up here and I'm going to get everybody up there and ask a lot of questions.
Chair Nelson, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Marty Sathoff. I'm the attorney in charge of the business transactions section for General Counsel, Department of Justice. The amendments that are before you are intended to address some of the concerns that were expressed by the committee and other members of the Senate regarding the original proposal to allow some flexibility in having agencies obtain services on proposed contracts prior to receiving an approval for legal sufficiency from the Attorney General's office. These amendments address that concern. In particular, they impose, they go back to the original language that prohibits agencies from obtaining services under contracts prior to obtaining legal sufficiency review and approval. In lieu of that, they insert a provision that would allow the Attorney General, upon request from an agency, to review that agency's program or class of contracts and possibly exempt a particular class of contract for an agency's program from the prohibition upon an assessment by the Attorney General that allowing that to occur for that particular program or agency would not cause undue risk to the state. It also allows the Department of Justice to go to other authorities, approving agencies, agencies who might have some approval capacity over the requesting agency or program, such as Department of Administrative Services, and ask for their input on whether or not that particular class of contract or agency's program, the type of business risk this might cause for the state.
The 97 legislature passed House Bill 2321. That required the AG to review for legal sufficiency all public contracts above a specified amount. The specified amount was 70.
For personal services and information technology, $75,000. For all other public contracts, $100,000. Those thresholds haven't changed.
Okay. So there's two types of public contracts. You have personal services and then all other contracts?
Personal services, information technology. Any information technology contract is at the $75,000 threshold level. Any other public contract would be at we would review it if it was $100,000 or more.
Okay. So the importance of this Senate Bill 398 is to implement the policy that we set out in the 1997 legislature. Okay. Any questions there? Further questions? Do you want to make any comments on this?
For the record, I'm Don Charlton, Chief Financial Officer of Human Resources, probably the largest by volume contractor in the state. Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, I'm here to say I support the bill. We need this for our business operations, and then answer any questions you may have.
You know, there's some testimony. There's thousands of contracts going through the Department of Human Resources. Is that correct?
Yes, several thousand go through us.
If this bill doesn't pass, what might be the effect upon your...
Well, we have situations where, for example, with large contracts with the counties, where or for mental health services, where we're negotiating multi-million-dollar contracts, generally for ongoing services with the counties, and we get into situations because of the circumstances of the different political bodies requiring approval, where we agree on the services, we generally agree on the terms and conditions, but it may be that. This doesn't get through a process in time to be in place on that date when the contract for services starts. For example, we had a situation in a county where the contract is very raw on both sides. It had to be approved by the county commission. It happened to be Christmas time. They canceled the meeting for shopping, I guess. And so we rolled into a January 1 implementation date without a contract. Ready to go. We did some footwork to bridge that period of time, but this would address the situation such as that.
I think the concern with some of the senators on the floor is the fact that this might be misused in some way. So is there any assurance that you can give this committee that that's not going to happen?
I can give you unequivocal, complete assurance that it won't be abused. My philosophy at the Department of Human Resources is come clean and stay clean, and anybody that wants to observe this process is free to. This is taking out the exceptional circumstances. Written into policies and procedures is by no means will anybody be allowed to abuse it. And that's my personal guarantee as well as that of Gary Weeks, the director of the farm.
I think some of the concerns that some of the senators have on the floor was that having a legal review of a big contract after it was already implemented was of limited value, that if there was going to be something that was legally improper about the contract, if you're doing that in private business, you would want to have it done first, the whole reason. But as I understand, a lot of the DHR contracts that we're concerned about are actually service contracts that I would call them boilerplate, pretty much. And I think the amendments get to that in terms of allowing the Attorney General to approve contracts. So that should take, am I correct in assuming that will take care of a large percentage of the body?
Mr. Chair, Senator Beyer, that's exactly correct. What this does is allow DOJ the ability to use judgment on when these processes should be used and when it makes sense. You make an important point. DHR deals primarily in contracts to clients and these county contracts. We very rarely have an A&E contract. And there are classes of contracts where it makes sense that this is implemented and not. And this allows the Attorney General to use judgment. So, yes, we try our darndest to get to a contract before we get there. Let me give you the opposite scenario, too. This also allows us some flexibility to not put a contractor in a tenuous situation, i.e. with a county. We've never used this negotiating tactic, but I have jokingly said we could. But we haven't, I assure you we haven't. We could say to the county, the statutes don't allow us to pay you for services performed before a contract's in place, before reviews are done. January 1 is coming up. If you don't sign exactly what we want here, we're not going to be paying you for your entitlement services. So this just gives us some leeway over that time period to negotiate in good faith with those entities we're contracting with, and allows it to be a fair process between the governments, for example, as opposed to now, which kind of, I mean, it's really black and white.
I would hope in those kinds of situations you're dealing with a major contract that the timing would be such that you realize that, have them reviewed, and a lot of the legal review, I assume, could be done with something like that. In fact, I assume you want to have the documents reviewed by your attorney before you went forward.
Absolutely. These documents we're talking about are inches thick, and absolutely, we start months and months ahead. When you're dealing with the state council, the department, the commissioners, they have questions and stuff. Sometimes you have trailer. I mean, I think you all folks come from a local area and have probably encountered that.
Cam, do you want to say you?
Mr. Chair, Cam Burney, Department of Administrative Services. I just believe that accountability is addressed and served well in the amendment before you today. It brings forth a supplemental founding of practices of the agency, whereas legal sufficiency is handled well by the Department of Justice. DAS would give it a business practices founding, which would make it a very complete accountability, and we endorse the amendments.
There's two different concepts, is what you
said. Right.
Legal sufficiency and what's, how do you...
Sound business practices.
Sound business practices. Okay. Sounds very good. Any further questions? Thank you very much. Oh, we're open to work session on these things. We'll get a little open to work session.
Mr. Chair,
yeah.
Move the A2
amendments. Senator Barr moves the dash A2 amendments to Senate Bill 398. Comments? Objections? Ordered.
And, Mr. Chair, I would move Senate Bill 398A as amended to the floor with a due pass.
Senator Barr moves Senate Bill 398A as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Comments? Objections? Ordered. Senator Barr, you want to continue to carry this?
Right again.
I'm sure things will go well. Open up a work session on Senate Bill 1089 relating to hazardous substance abuse for dry cleaning facilities.
Mr. Chair, on April 14th, the committee heard two bills related to funding the dry cleaner environmental response account. One proposal embedded in Senate Bill 1089 proposed an increase to the solvent fee surcharge, actually proposed a decrease to the solvent fee surcharge and an increase to, I'm trying to remember the bill now, to a per facility charge evenly distributed among all the dry cleaning facilities in order to make up a shortfall in the collection. If you remember, the account is intended as an insurance policy for dry cleaning facilities. If there is any contamination found on the site, cleanup will be assumed through payment of that fund, as opposed to the facility having its own financial liability. The statutory goal of $1 million has not been met in any of the years since this program has been in place, and the attempt to address that shortfall were expressed in two different approaches. 1089 would distribute the shortfall among all of the dry cleaning facilities equally, and 1263 ultimate proposal, which would distribute the shortfall basically by reassessing the contribution to that account through a 2% gross receipt charge. And after the hearing, members of the Oregon Dry Cleaners Association and the Korean Dry Cleaners Association and representatives of the Department of Revenue and Department of Environmental Quality met to further explore ways to come together in a very brief time. And what you see in front of you in the Dash 1 amendment is the agreement that was struck among these interest parties. I think with one caveat, even with this agreement and the revenue collection ought to increase beyond the current level, we do not project the $1 million target is going to be met. And therefore, there needs to be some additional work beyond this session in order for that statutory requirement to be fulfilled. I'd like to review with you very quickly the effects of committee amendments. The first item is there were some changes proposed to reducing the solvent fee in the 1089 bill. We deleted those changes, which means that we continue with what is set in current statute related to surcharges associated with dry cleaning solvents. The second change is currently statute applies an annual facility fee to certain dry cleaning facilities. And there are exemptions made to stores that have a lower gross revenue, annual revenue. And those exemptions are repealed, which means the annual facility fee will be applied evenly to all facilities. The third change is there is a very strong interest from the dry cleaning community to know easily who has paid that annual fee. And we had cooperation from the Department of Revenue, which would allow issuing not only a certificate upon payment of the annual fee, and therefore, and the certificate is required to be displayed on the premise. So anyone can easily spot or verify if the payment had been made. And then secondly, the Department of Revenue will annually make available a list of facilities that have paid the fee. And finally, there, at the request of the dry cleaners community, there are two additional fee-related items imposed in this bill. The first one is civil penalties up to $5,000 for failure to pay any of the required fees. And there was much discussion on what ought to be the maximum level of civil penalties. And just so you know, to put this $5,000 in perspective, the original request from the Korean Dry Cleaners Association was $100,000 for failure to pay $1,000 annual fee. So they take this very seriously, just offer that information. And secondly, there will be a $2,500 fee applied to new stores. And the thinking is, since all the current stores have paid into the startup cost of setting up this program, and new stores coming into this program immediately benefit from the infrastructure, that there's some rationale for applying an initiation fee of sorts. And if you have concern about the legality of that issue, there have been cursory discussions with legislative counsel, and they do not see any problems associated with it. And with that, if you have additional questions, I see that we do have representatives from the Learning Dry Cleaners Association here, and Department of Environmental Quality, and Department of Revenue. I'm sure they'll be happy to provide further information and answer your questions.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Chair, the annual fee goes from $500 to $1,000.
The annual fee currently is a three-tier structure. For dry stores, the stores that only do collection and no on-site washing, if the revenue is below $50K a year, they pay nothing. If the revenue is above $50, they pay $500. And then for the wet stores, the stores that actually do the laundry, it's $1,000. in this bill, every store pays $1,000, and I think the concept of it is because it's an insurance fund. Regardless of volume of business, there is some logic in everybody pays because everyone benefits.
Further questions? Roger, do you want to make a statement? DQ, are there representatives of DQ that...
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Ann Price. I'm with the Department of Environmental Quality. I'm the Hazardous Waste Program Manager.
Okay. Do you have any comment on this and amendments to the bill as proposed?
Mr. Chair, I think that the issue is concerned about the fact that it will not still meet the $1 million, keeping in mind that the $1 million was an amount that was set out to keep the program moving. It is not an amount that was calculated to actually provide sufficient money to fund all of the cleanups that we believe will be possible that will come in over the years. We are concerned that that the solvent fee, as it continues to increase, might lead to some mismanagement of the solvent, as well as we would like, we have expressed in the past that an opportunity to provide a capacity, a fee based on capacity, might be helpful. But we do support the fact that there is an effort being made to actually fund the program and the efforts that are being on the program, which we think are very successful.
Okay, I mean, the object of this is it's basically an insurance program, the self-regulated part of the industry, and the Department of Environmental Quality went along with this when the original statute was...
That's correct.
Have you had any... What are the partial experiences under this bill now? How many cleanups have you done, or how many checked, or has there been serious problems, or anything of that nature?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, the program itself is running very well. We have now 13 cleanups underway. There are 15 total that are in with applications. It is a program that the individual dry cleaners come forth themselves with applications, so we don't seek out individuals that's needing cleanup. The actual interaction between the industry and the DEQ and implementing the cleanups, I think, has been very successful. Also, we are about to kick off an entire technical assistance effort to support the waste management requirements, compliance requirement portion of the program to assist the industry in making them aware of what their obligations are for compliance under law. So the actual functioning of the program itself is going very well. The concern just remains about having the money to actually do the cleanup that we'd like to be able to do.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Roger Martin, and I represent the Oregon Dry Cleaners Association. One of my directors just reminded me that, or just commented that with the prospective increase for the gallonage in October, the projection is that we will, in fact, meet the $1 million goal. I guess it's kind of a moot question one way or the other, because we have been functioning perhaps not as fast as either party would like, but we have gotten along very well with the DEQ. There is one area that was talked about, and I guess decided not to go in the bill here, and that's the idea of getting the Oregon Attorney General to join in lawsuit against the manufacturers modeled after a case in Texas where a large dry cleaning chain brought a suit against the manufacturer of this material and succeeded in collecting the entire amount of money to clean it up. I think for everybody concerned, if that kind of lawsuit were successful here in Oregon, we'd probably fund the entire program and not have to continue to increase fees. But that was a point that I know the DEQ has a difference of opinion on funding the Attorney General.
Sure, if I might comment. We're actually looking at that as a possible option, but as you know, with all litigation, and particularly product liability litigation, it's very extensive and very expensive, and so we're not prepared at this time to encourage taking the already limited funds and putting it toward that litigation at this time, but we are evaluating whether or not that would be a good and viable option for us.
And so the DEQ would be the plaintiff in the suit. How about the dry cleaners? Would they be involved in it?
I'm not quite sure how it works, but there are private sector attorneys interested in bringing the suit. there's some good legal thinking, including the Attorney General, and that would speed things up. But it's Friday afternoon, and you're not going to settle our issue, so let's forget that.
Okay. Further questions?
Like I said, one.
Yes.
As I recall from our previous discussion, you still have about $1.2 million in account, give or take. Is that not, that has not yet been expended?
Sure, something that's correct.
So with the increase, I mean, I know you expressed a concern about keeping the program, you know, going in a systematic way. So would this then do that? I mean, between now and the next biennium, have you to keep the program going with the existing reserves and the new fees?
Well, Mr. Chair, Senator Musker, it's uncertain, but because of the way the nature of cleanup projects get in the queue, basically, and so the projections that we have of the existing projects that we already have in the door, so to speak, the $1.2 million would not meet the needs even for those projects. So yes, while over time as we continue to get money in, we are kind of inching along, we still don't have enough to pay the bottom line, basically, on the projects that we currently have in the door. And our expectation is that we will receive more applications as all dry cleaners are looking towards, you know, seeing if this is an opportunity, since they're paying into it, is this an opportunity they can take advantage of.
Mr. Chair. Not a question, but two comments before the committee deliberates on this bill. One, it is important for the committee to, I think, put on the record appreciation for the contributions and participation of a lot of folks who really actively contributed from the dry cleaner community, and specifically Mr. Moon Do Pak, who is president of the Korean Association of Dry Cleaners. And Philip Oh, who is the vice president, and James King, who is attorney assisting that association, and of course you're familiar with Roger Martin and the other folks associated with the Oregon Dry Cleaner Association. And the other item is, it's important, I believe, for the committee to put on the record some direction for parties of interest. You have heard about the question of the $1 million target, whether that is going to be reached. And it perhaps it's appropriate for the staff to draft something that would, one, allow the committee to commend the strong commitment expressed by the community to work fully funding this account, and two, for the committee to support not only a very aggressive implementation of the funding formula proposed in Senate Bill 1089, and encourage the dry cleaning community to kind of help with the self-monitoring and make sure that the collection rate can increase, because as I understand, right now we're at 80 to 90% collection success, and that there are funds that are not collected. And if that could be increased, then obviously the shortfall could be partially addressed through that mechanism. And perhaps direct the group, the parties of interest, to continue to monitor the level of collection, as well as the total revenue compared to the $1 million target that's set, and an estimated cost of the cleanup needs, and work during the interim before the next legislative session. If there continue to be clearing inadequacies in this current funding proposal, then something else will have to be done in the next session.
Okay. Good. Have you done a cleanup session?
Mr. Chair, I believe there's one that is completed, and we are, you know, many are underway.
What was the cost of the one that was completed? You know,
I don't know that off the top of my head.
Can you just get that to everybody?
Sure. Exactly.
Any further questions?
Mr. Chair, I just want to add two things. I appreciate what the committee administrator said about recommending everybody work together. Would you please tell the Department of Revenue to be a little more forthcoming to all of us about the information? They'll say they can't because it's a secret. And the other thing, if all of you would spill something in your clothes and have them dry clean, we'd appreciate it.
just on the point that Mr. Martin just made about the Department of Revenue sharing information, we did look at the statutory prohibition at this point on sharing that information, and the amendment that's actually addressed.
I'm anxious to see how it works.
If Mr. Martin sees that carefully, I think he will find that it's to his satisfaction.
You're worried about the cost of the world. Do people don't listen to what we say down here?
I don't know.
This could go on like this. Any further comments? The chair would move the dash one amendment. Is that correct?
Yes.
Dash one amendment. Any comments? Objections? So moved. The chair would move Senate Bill 1089 as amended to the floor of the Duke Pass recommendation. Comments? Objections? Seeing none, ordered. Senator Mitchell, you want to say anything?
Happy to.
Oh, thank you.
I'm going to close directly for the day.
Okay. Open up a work session on Senate Bill 1127, converting 22 boards to semi-independent state agency status.
Mr. Chair, the committee heard this bill on April 19th, and at that time we heard a number of issues raised.
Yeah, 1120, here's one right here. Do you have to?
If you look at the staff measure summary that was just distributed, you'll see that under the effect of committee amendments, a list of actions which were taken to address the concerns that were shared with you during the public hearing. And specifically, the dash 3 amendment, which is a thick package that you have, but I don't expect you to get it out of it. Does these four key things. The first one is it removes those boards that do not wish to become semi-independent. And prior to the meeting, your staff, your administrator did hear that there might be one discrepancy that would need to be corrected. The second item is it would maintain current board appointment process. There were some questions raised about the election of known public members and the question of how to keep separation, or how to keep these boards independent, unbiased, and different from the functions of a trade association. And so after consultation with a number of interested parties, the decision is to go back to the current appointment process, which means that the governor would nominate and it will be confirmed by the Senate, and it's set out in statute. The third item relates to auditing requirements, balancing accountability of these boards once they become semi-independent with the cost and time associated with the performance audit as well as the financial audit. So in this amendment, there is the requirement of a financial audit, and you may know that the Secretary of State has the constitutional jurisdiction over financial audit of state agencies. That continues, but it also states clearly in the amendment that the Secretary of State may allow or elect to accept outside independent certified public accountants to conduct the audit. On the performance audit component, which is the basis for the concern of cost, because they do cost a lot of money, in this amendment, it is addressed by having the organizations or these boards do a self-report to the Legislative Assembly and the governor, which means that the same information will still need to be made available, and the belief is that is a efficient yet effective way to continue that kind of accountability to the public. And then finally, it would allow affected boards and staff to retain their original hire dates and accumulated leave. And the language that in the amendment addresses a concern in the desire to have a seamless transfer between the same individual serving currently in state agency capacities and then in the future into a semi-independent status. If you look at the amendment, basically the auditing requirement is spelled out in the financial reporting requirements are spelled out in sections 6 and 7. And the performance audit, which now has changed over to a self-reporting, and the elements retained in that self-reporting are on page 7 or section 11. And as you'll note, that list of 13 items continue to reinforce what you have thought were important areas that the board needs to pay attention to and the legislative body ought to know about. And the majority of the amendments continues to address the Children's Trust Fund, which is the only anomaly out of this group in terms of how it would change from a state agency. The Children's Trust Fund is proposed in this amendment, which was actually spelled out in the earlier amendment, but the committee did not take action on it. It is for this entity to switch from a state agency to a semi-independent organization, then to a not-for-profit organization. And section 34 to 51 begins with page 21, addresses the provisions which would govern this transition for the Children's Trust Fund. I know in the audience we have a lot of representatives from a variety of organizations that have an interest in this topic. If you would like to hear further from anybody, I'm sure they'll be happy to come.
I think if they just have if there's any concerns or objections to the amendment, that's not just going to be
sort of sure that because this bill has a clearly a financial fiscal impact, and you have heard from Susan Fosterman, Department of Administrative Services, a very rough cost estimate of the impact on DAS. But that was the original proposal of 22 boards and commissions, and as you can see in the amendment, we have a much smaller group now involved in this. This bill has a prior referral to Ways and Means, and it will be just as easy for any modifications to take place over there. So the committee, if it chooses, can actually take action, move this to Ways and Means, and have the financial impact as well as other minor changes to be addressed.
Okay, was there anybody that had any concerns or objections to the proposed amendment? Yes, sir, about it.
So how many of these, did we leave these health agencies?
Members, if you take a look at the first page of the dash three amendment, you will see section one are the group that the board that remains.
Okay, five.
And then section two speaks to the Children's Trust Fund. And then section three are the current five entities that have gone through an external period, and in statute there is a sunset provision 4 years into the experiment, and this bill repeals that provision and include them in section three because since we're making changes to the board nomination process, the hire dates for employees, etc., this is the cleanest way to make sure that the actual five that are currently going through this change are subjected to the exact same provisions and conditions and requirements that are imposed on this new group.
Section one are those that currently are not semi-independent and will be added to that status?
That's correct.
And transferred from the health division, is that?
Health and other things from our health.
Okay, any further comments or questions?
I guess in listening to the testimony the last time this was up, I do have some reservations about the moving the health occupation forms to that status, and I think a little conflict with the nature of regulation and whether that should be. I thought that the speakers, particularly Ed Patterson, made some good points about that. Feeling a little reluctant to do that.
Let's see, Dad out here, I don't... Oh, here, well, there he is. Mr. Carnegie, would you like to make a comment?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, Ed Patterson, representing the Oregon Association of Hospitals and Health Systems, and I apologize that there was not a copy of the amendments back there. I've not seen the amendments. And I guess the comments Senator Beyer was talking about is, I think, consistent with our policy, at least, we think that health professional boards should be treated differently than other boards because of the significant role they play in our society. And it's been our experience that we need more oversight and less autonomy rather than more autonomy and less oversight because of the importance of that. If there are health-related boards in the Section 1, then I would request they be taken out.
Well, there's the Board of Massage Technicians, Board of Naturopathic Examiners, Physical Therapist Licensing Board, and the Board of Radiologic Technology. Radiologic.
Mr. Chair, based on that information, I think the two inappropriate boards that I see in there, thank you very much, would be the physical therapist and the radiology technologist. Radiology technologists, essentially, I would say in the neighborhood of 90% of the radiology technologists work in hospitals, and very few work outside that facility. And therefore, we're very concerned about the quality of the licensure process, and we'd like to have more public insight into how the board's conducting themselves. Physical therapists are also working in hospitals, but much smaller percentage, probably in the neighborhood of 50% work in hospitals, and we are concerned about those. Those are mainstream technicians, technologists that we are concerned about and want to maintain the highest quality. And I think if you grant too much autonomy, the potential for abuse, if you will, exists. And we would like to see those two at least taken out.
Any comments?
I guess I share some breath from the, let's say, the hospital perspective. And just in general, I think we have had, we haven't had a real clear policy. We bounced around. In fact, boards and commissions, that's been an issue that's been a matter of debate for at least the last three sessions. And certainly in the public's mind, there's a lot of concern about health boards and whether the changes in insurance practices for consumers are as protective as they should be or used to be. And my comments in no way infer any disrespect for the boards that are currently operating and the job that they're doing. It's just the nature of, if you're going to have a regulatory framework, I think it needs to, and on those where you're dealing with people's health, it seems like it's better under the auspices of the public agency. I have some reluctance to do that.
Would you be comfortable if they passed this off today with kind of the ways and means and with the notation or with the understanding that there are concerns about these keys and the way the board is trying to work at it through the process because of a little bit short of time and probably will have an opportunity to look at it.
My sense is you're debt-free, though.
we understand the concern. Thank you for the gentleman's concern. And there are some good things about this bill, and I know Senator Bryan came in, I think, and proposed that he was saying we really wanted to be flexible and to make sure we didn't include agencies that we shouldn't be including, and but there was some real value to it. So I think it's something we can say. So you can.
Well, I was going to question, Mr. Chair. Are there other boards here in that same situation that are not did not want to be included in this document? I mean,
I think contacted most of the boards, and we did. Yes.
And Central Michigan, the boards that do not wish to become semi independent, if they have communicated in writing to your administrator, then they are out. And that's reflected in the amendment process. If there is any discrepancy, I believe it would be very minor. And that ought to be able to be addressed in the Ways and Means Committee process.
I share Senator Beyer's concerns, and I guess I'm open as to what is the best approach. To dealing with this. I'm certainly aware of the time crunch. Also aware of making sure that we don't discharge a duty that doesn't then take place. I guess I'd almost, in this case, defer to Senator Byers' opinion on this.
Okay. If the chair wants to move it down to Ways and Means, I'll give that courtesy as long as my concern is registered on that.
I think the concerns are valid, and I think we would not require that in a registration process.
And that'll go down there before it gets to the floor.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Before we bring it back on the floor, we make sure those concerns are addressed. And, Okay. Discussion. Any further comments? Any other agencies that want to discuss something? The chair would move the Dastrey amendments to Senate Bill 1127. I guess the comments would be that the acceptance would be subject to this concern we have over Section 1. Subsection 3 and 4, the Physical Therapist Licensing Board and the Board of Radiologic Technology, and that would be addressed in the Ways and Means process and monitored by this committee.
So the motion was to move it to Ways and Means?
Yeah, we can just accept amendments.
Okay.
So we're talking about accepting amendments with that concern from this committee.
Yeah.
Any objections? So ordered. The chair would move 1127-as amended to the Ways and Means Committee with the understanding that in Section 1 and Subsection 3 and 4 on the first page of the amendments that there is concern about the Physical Therapist Licensing Board and the Board of Radiologic Technology. And that this committee would monitor those and address the concerns expressed by members of the committee.
If you would, Mr. Chair, would I just the health observation board just to take a look at that?
Okay. All right. Mm-hmm. And add on to that, the health occupation boards to study this matter and the concerns as raised by Mr. Patterson in this process. Any objections to the motion? Senator Bryant may be here for Senate Bill 712, so we'll skip over that until he has an opportunity to be here. Open up a work session on Senate Bill 1034. Modifying definition of restricted energy electric activity for purposes of electrical licensing exemption under electrical safety law for licensed landscaping.
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
The committee heard this bill on April 23rd. At that time, issues discussed involved the basis for restricted energy electric activity, setting that level at 100 volt ampere. And the applications are primarily limited to outdoor sprinklers, automatic sprinklers, they electrically use for the sprinkler control as well as outdoor lights. And at that time, there were some discussions between members of the Building Code Division, the Electrical Inspection Office, and the Landscape Contractors Association representatives on what is the best way to fill in the blank in the bill. If you remember, the original bill had a blank in it that was seeking to modify or increase the current level of 100 volt amp, but there was not a number plug in there. And you have a copy of the -3 amendment in front of you. And in -3, it restored the original 100, which means that it says it now offers a new definition for restricted energy electrical activity in order by statute. And the new definition clarifies that there are two types of electrical systems that will be included in this restricted energy electrical definition. The first one is the current 100 volt amp limit, and that would apply to Class 2 and Class 3 installations. And then the second one, which is new, in addition, is a new 300 volt amp limit. And that would be limited only to landscaping low voltage lighting system, which was a specific example offered in the testimony when you conducted your hearing on the 23rd.
So what we're doing now through this amendment is to clarify not only the original 100 volt amp limit applies in cases of Class 2 and 3 installations, but in addition recognizing that when it's used for landscape low voltage lighting systems, that it's okay for us to increase the limit to 300 volt amps. And if that's not clear enough, you could take a look at the Dash 3 amendment and see the actual wording that talks about installations that do not exceed 300 volt amps for landscape voltage lighting systems. And there is a provision attached to those low voltage lighting systems. They have to be port connected to a ground fault circuit interrupter receptacle, which is a safety system allowing for basically a circuit breaker kind of a system to avoid shock and injury in the outdoor environment.
Sure.
Yes.
Yeah. Sure. I'm trying to figure out how this amendment works. In 9.14, after installation, is this section just inserted there?
Mm-hmm.
Like that, and then the rest of it is left in?
Okay.
That actually comes after the end of dwelling. The way the amendment is structured, I think we need to make clear to legislative council and mayor who pass it this way that they do leave the rest of that in there because it's got a period in it now.
Okay.
And it's not, Sherry's got it in there, the recommended language is correct. Mm-hmm. If we pass it, this will just name it. Period, but it isn't clear when you maintain this. Usually it says when you maintain the rest of the land.
We have the intent on the, it's just you're talking about some punctuation or?
Yeah, eliminate the period.
You just, what Senator Biden was talking about is if you look at line 14 of the bill, we want to make sure after installation on line 14, we have inserted a sentence that says, or that do not exceed 300 volt amp, et cetera, to the receptacle, which is the new amendment language, that we retain the rest of that sentence that says under the electrical specialty code and the one and two family dwelling code.
This is something that legislative council can take over.
Yeah, just to make sure that they, it's important that they have that last piece in
there. Yeah.
I think it is.
Any further comments?
It may be a difference for the building because we're living here.
if you have any further questions, we
what
have
is the difference of opinion?
We have representatives here to answer those
questions. But that is the intent.
Well, yes, and the original proposed change came to me from Gary Wilson, who is the state's chief electrical inspector. And the intent was to after the DFCI, the ground fault circuit interruption receptacle, to indicate that it is under the electrical specialty code and rental family dwelling code.
Dwelling code division does not have any problems with amendments. We're fine with that.
Okay.
All right. Okay. Okay. We
move it in.
Yeah, I opened up the public work session on this, and I did open up the work session at about 10:34.
Move it as three amendments, 10:34.
Mr. Starr moves the amendment to set about 10:34. Any comments? Objections? Ordered?
10:34. The floor of the due pass recommendation as amended.
Mr. Starr moves set about 10:34 as amended to the floor of the due pass recommendation. Comments? Objections? Order. Thank you. Now, I think Keith stepped out and asked to skip over that. So, down to this one. So we go back to 7-12. You might go back.
It's
kind of why I was going to show up, but let's open up public hearing at about 7-1-12, 7-1-2, and there's some folks. I don't have a sign up list. Who signed up to testify? Please come step forward. Bell 712.
Okay, if I go first on the list.
Sure. We'll start with Lisa down.
Mr. Chairman, my name is Jan Wick. This bill is prepared by Senator Bryant, or sponsored by Senator Bryant. I actually asked, I own Avion Water Company in Bend, Oregon, and I asked Senator Bryant to craft up the bill. Avion Water Company operates in the urban and rural environment of Deschutes County, Cook County. We currently serve about 7,000 households in those two counties. I asked the Oregon Utilities Commission to review the possibility of service territory allocations for water companies 2 years ago. The PUC indicated at that time that they felt that might be a good idea. Currently, my company is regulated by the Oregon Health Division, the Oregon Public Utilities Commission, and the Environmental Protection Agency. We keep pretty busy with regulation. I've asked that Senator Bryant to sponsor this bill to actually, in a way, further the regulation in an attempt to simplify our own lives. In the area that in which we live, there's a considerable gentrification occurring within the countryside. There are a large number of private water utility companies. There are four fairly large ones and quite a number of small ones. Water utilities, I believe, are probably the last true natural monopoly. I don't think that anybody is going to figure out a reasonable way to put two water lines or mains down streets and introduce some sort of competitive environment once the water system's in place. Additionally, the infrastructures for water systems, including storages, water rights, main transmission mains, require a substantial engineering type of knowledge, and that knowledge needs to include the number of customers that you will eventually expect to deal with within a certain area. This bill provides for service territory allocations amongst private water utilities. It's my understanding that the League of Oregon Cities has felt that the bill may have some impact upon water districts and municipal water providers. It was not my intention that this bill have any impact whatsoever on municipal water suppliers. Well, I see a committee just interested as all get out here. You guys hear about the grasshopper that came into the bar and ordered a drink, and the bartender said, "Do you have a drink named after you?" And the grasshopper said, "Do you have a drink named Steve?" Is there any reason to continue?
No, I think they're doing fine.
I mean, I drove 120 miles to do this, and I feel a little insulted, to tell you the truth.
By whom? By
your cohort. I think that...
Well, I apologize for that. There's several committee hearings on it, and everybody has their bills. I was waiting for Senator Bryant to come in.
I
understand. He can help testify, but he's testifying at another committee also.
Sorry.
Don't take it personally. Maybe because I'm up there.
Yeah.
Well, I have had a conversation with the League of Oregon Cities representative and with the Oregon Utilities Commission. And although I have no authority to amend this bill, I would recommend to Senator Bryant that the bill be amended so that it more clearly states, I think it does say it now, but it more clearly states that it is not the intention of the bill to regulate municipalities. There is a requirement in the bill that municipalities and districts submit only maps of their service territories to the Oregon Utilities Commission in order to, so the commission can simply coordinate its activities. Those are not for approval purposes. Should Senator Bryant agree to that amendment? I think that the Oregon Utilities Commission does, although Roger Lundau didn't want to speak for himself. And I believe that representatives are here from the League of Oregon Cities as well, who would withdraw their objections to the bill on the conditions that such an amendment is made. I believe it's in the public's best interest that the bill be passed with the proposed amendment. If you have any questions, I'd be happy to answer them.
Thank you very much. Let's start from the PUC, and then we'll go.
Thank you.
Stay right there if you'd like to say, John. Some of the senators may come back.
Chair Nelson, Senator Starr. I should tell a story briefly about the time I took my kids to the Senate, the United States Senate, and big session was going on, big debate over a bill. I think it had to do with workers' comp. And the only two people in the chambers was Orrin Hatch and Ted Kennedy were converting this bill. And no one else was there, but it was all being read into the record, so it was being heard.
You've got powerful people up here, too.
That's right.
Senator Starr is better to know.
I'm Roger Hamilton from the Public Utility Commission, and we do support this bill. And it is not an attempt to extend our regulatory authority over the cities of the state. As Jan mentioned, water utilities are, of all the industries we regulate, probably the truest of natural monopolies due to their high capital-intensive nature. There's only one investor-owned water utility that I know of. It's the Salmon Valley Utility in the Welch's area that does have designated service territory. And there have been several situations where these have been desirable. And this isn't Jan's effort to bring this to us has not been without other support. This would also require an obligation to serve, which can be extremely important with respect to customers in those investor-owned utility territories that we allocate. Most important, as Jan mentioned, was to be very clear on what this does not do. On first blush, we did not think there was a question about what this bill did not do, but it does not require an application process of municipalities or restrict the powers granted to cities to issue franchises or affect condemnation. It doesn't preclude the formation of homeowner associations or cooperatives within the designated service territories. It doesn't require an application process of the IOUs that are located within Lane County Boundary Commission, which already has allocated service territories, or the Metro Service District, Clackamas, Multnomah, and Washington Counties. It does not invalidate existing service territories of IOUs, and does not require an application process for a water utility district. We're very willing to work on language to make sure that the cities are not impacted in any way except in a minor way, and that is that there is an explicit provision that if there's a request upon by our staff for a map showing the boundaries of the current city utility, that be provided. We don't expect a fiscal impact, even though there may be 200 or so utilities, IOUs, mostly very small, affected. We would extend the statutory requirement of 120 days and make sure that we had an easy flow of workload to process these. There's usually no great urgency, and those who do feel a sense of urgency would come in, I'm sure, early in the process. So with that, I would simply say that we're willing to work on any amendments that would respond to the objections of the cities in this case.
Thank you very much. Well, if you want to come up and get yourself sit there if you want to. Yeah, Michael, if she has 120 miles, might as well stay in the spot. A few more minutes, anyway.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, I'm Willie Tiffany with the League of Oregon Cities, and as the proponents have said, we initially had some concerns regarding the definition of water utility. We since worked those out conceptually, and if the bill is amended to take out public water utilities, including cities and special districts, then we would have no position on this bill.
Are you in work with amendments? We can take care of it.
Happy to do that.
Thank you.
and share you with your trip, but not in vain. There's only two of us out there. We'll get this thing worked on and get it done and talk to Senator Bryant and Sherry. I'll get involved with getting the right amendments and we'll take care of business.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Maybe I shouldn't be quite such a smart aleck.
Well, that's all right. That probably does us good. That's what we're up to. You know another joke?
yeah. Actually, I know a lot of them, but some of them are rather salacious.
Thank you very much. Yes, do you have your phone number?
Yes, my phone number is 541-382-5342. Actually, I do know one really, I think it was one of the only clean jokes that Sam Snead knows. And I actually heard Sam Snead tell it. It's really kind of cute. Sam told about a good old boy that bought a brand new Mercedes. And he just loved his new car. It was one of those great big ones, really fast. So he took it out on the road, rural road, just to see how fast it was going. It's going about 90. And he looked up in the rear vision mirror, and here came the state policeman, and everything go on, you know. Okay. No, I think I'll try and outrun this guy in my new Mercedes. They just floored it. Got up to 135, and the state policeman was still catching up, so I said, oh, heck, yes. Carl will probably go faster, but I can't, so he stopped. The state policeman came up and he said, you know, I've already written 65 tickets today. If you can give me an excuse that I've never heard before as to why you were running away from me, I'll be really, really happy not to give you a ticket and just give you a warning. The guy said, well, 2 years ago, my wife ran away with a state policeman, and I was afraid you were bringing her back.
Hey, so I can, for the work session, sir, you don't have to come back for the work session. But you can if you want to come back. And then
you got another good joke, yeah.
Well, those are some things.
Mr. Chair. You're laughing. I want you to know that I heard all of that, and I heard the story about Orrin Hatch and Kennedy, and I was listening to the hearing, even though I was not in the room.
Okay, we'll open the work session on Senate Bill 915, Mr. Shepard.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Keith Shepard. I'm the attorney in charge of the Financial Fraud Consumer Protection section, and I feel a heavy burden following that testimony. I know some jokes, but I can't tell them. Mr. Chair, you should have the, and members of the committee, you should have the DAS 2 amendments to Senate Bill 915. This is the bill, the committee recalls, that attempts to deal with the workability problems that now exist in Oregon's black dot non-solicitation telephone call law. And those are problems both for consumers for whom these calls are a significant annoyance, and for businesses that try to comply with the law, but because the lists are not updated regularly, it's difficult for legitimate businesses using a legitimate marketing tool to do their business in compliance with Oregon law. The aim of the proposal is to create a, by contract with the Department of Justice, a private entity contract administrator who will maintain a single comprehensive list. That was the version in the Dash 1 amendments, and in the Department of Justice's view, it solved the problems for consumers and for businesses. The problem that it created, however, the Dash 1 amendments for Sprint in particular, was that Sprint and presumably other companies that do business on a national basis would like to be able to use their own professional associations as a central list for all of their do not call information, so that they only have to make one contact in order to make sure that they don't contact Oregonians who don't wish to be contacted. So what the Dash 2 amendments do is provide that, open up the list that's maintained by the administrator to such a qualified national trade association, so that the National Trade Association could get the list and then pass that list on to its members, thus satisfying the concern that Sprint raised. And I believe I can report to you that Mr. Shaw has indicated to me that he and I both are juggling between two hearings this afternoon. I appreciate the chair's consideration there, but he indicated to me that we have solved Sprint's problems with the bill. It appears, however, that we've created a question by doing that. And let me tell you what that question is. It turns out that others have now recognized that being the administrator may be a very valuable contract to have. That's a good position to be in, and there perhaps is some money to be made as the administrator of this list. And so it appears that some organizations perhaps would like to be able to qualify themselves as an organization to get that contract in addition to the qualified national trade associations. My summary of this, and perhaps there may be others who can testify, Mr. Bauer, I believe, is the one who expressed those concerns. My summary, then, of the bill for the moment for the committee is this. I believe it solves the problem that we set out to solve, the workability problem for consumers and for businesses. And so we would urge the committee to adopt the Dash 2 amendments. We would pledge that we would work with the Oregon Telecommunications Association if indeed there are some specific concerns that they have about the position and qualifications for these administrators, but it seems to us that's really a sideshow to the main event here, which is to try and do something for businesses and consumers, and we think this is a reasonably creative and innovative way to solve that problem.
Okay. Sounds very good. We'll kind of close the work session on this. I'd like to reopen the work session on Senate Bill. Let's take care of Senator Bryant real quick. Open up the a comfortable work session on Senate Bill 712. We had the public hearing and you attended.
Possible work session. My name is Neil Bryant.
That's what you say.
Yeah. You're real careful.
You know, Joe, you're your constituent.
He told me that. He said he was concerned when he came to the microphone, everyone left. He said, it's just you and Sherry. And he said, uh-oh, is the day over? He said, he ended great. He said, he left you laughing. And so you can't wait. He's waiting out there, waiting to tell me these two jokes. More important than the bill at the moment. Mr. Chair, I appreciate you hearing the bill. I understand the minor amendments the city wants. I'm willing to do that. My preference would be to go ahead and send the bill out, and I'll make that change on the outside. And I'll make that commitment to you and also on the floor of the Senate. So if you wouldn't mind moving the bill today, I appreciate it.
Really? And now any questions or problems with doing that?
I think it works good.
Thank you.
Thank you. Chair, we've got Bill 915. Is that the
number? 712.
712, excuse me. We've got Bill 712. I'm a little confused about this. Following the due pass recommendation with the understanding that Senator Bryan will work to correct any discrepancies on that particular side. Any comments, objections? So ordered. And Senator Bryan will carry this bill. Yeah. Okay, we're back. We'll reopen the work session. This is the work session on 9:15, right? Okay, we'll open the work session on 9:15. I think it's probably still the final situation with 9:15 and 7:12, isn't it?
Move the Dash 2 amendment.
Senator Starr, move the Dash 2 amendment. Any comments?
Mr. Chair, 9:15 has a subsequent referral to judiciary.
Okay. So, if there's no objection to the Dash 2, that will move Senate Bill 915
as amended to judiciary.
As amended to judiciary. Let's just try it
again.
If they do pass recommendation. Any comments? Objections? So ordered. We'll just move right along here. Open up a public hearing. No, let's see. This is a work session. Excuse me. Open up a work session on Senate Bill 785. And yeah, who are the folks who want to come?
I don't have a sign of sheet, so
Mr.
just a second. Come on
up. Go ahead.
For Senate Bill 75, you have a Dash 1 amendment. In front of you, it may be helpful to take a look at that amendment. Just want to make sure you have that as a gift. And if you have a copy of the bill, the amendment will be. through the period on line 16, beginning with if and municipality, and then the rest of the paragraph from line 17 to 19. This bill is about standards for building officials and inspectors. And you might remember from the last testimony that you heard concerns from the building officials, the difficulty of recruiting and filling positions because they feel the qualification standards are too high. And then you heard from the state building code officials the concern of not eroding the standards and continue to have high-quality individuals to perform the work of building officials and inspectors for public safety well-being. What the amendment does is it provides for, requires DCBS to rule, clarify the practical experience equivalent of the minimum standards, therefore providing for some degree of flexibility, but it would not, as the original bill intends, put the ball and the decisions in the courts of municipalities. And I'm sure Mr. Cross and Mr. Brewer would be able to speak more to that bill. And I believe John Trevain, who did not have an opportunity to speak to in the public hearing, may have some input.
Okay.
For the record, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Joe Brewer. I'm the administrator of the Building Codes Division. I'd like to begin by complimenting Ms. Shung on her command of electrical terminology. I've never heard anyone be so succinct in describing volt amperes and other issues such as that. My understanding of the amendment is that it would basically require the department to put together a process for field examining candidates for certification who may not meet necessarily all of the written qualification standards. And my understanding of that is that that individual would need to be close. We're not talking about someone who meets half the requirements, but someone who comes close and perhaps doesn't meet the letter of the requirements, requiring us again to put together a field examination process. I do know a joke. I'd be happy to tell that later on if anyone would like to hear it, but I'd be happy to take any questions.
Well,
Mr. Chairman, for the record, my name is Bill Cross. I'm with the Oregon Building Officials Association. We would support the amendment. We're not a little uncomfortable with not having the opportunity for the jurisdictions who are the ones that are screening these individuals and would like to, you know, be able to try and apply a practical examination as the applicants file for job position openings. On the other hand, we would like to get established a rule or a procedure that would allow BCD to provide an alternative to the experience requirements, the length of experience requirements, because there are instances where we've got people that otherwise would be qualified, we think have the practical abilities to do it, but don't have enough hours or their work experience doesn't totally fit the description of acceptable experience. So this would at least move us a step closer, and we would support it with that in mind.
Senator Byer.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Joe, this still puts the agency in a position of certifying.
Through the chair, Senator Byer, yes, that's my understanding. The certification standards and evaluation would still be coordinated, exercised by the department, and would not be diffused to the 125, 30 jurisdictions we have in the state.
Well,
thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, my name is John Gabay, representing the National Electrical Contractors Association. I'm also going to make comments on behalf of the IBEW, Local 48, the Plumbing Contractors, and the Plumbing Union Local 290. As it relates to Senate Bill 785, I think that the amendments make it much better. I wasn't aware of that earlier on. I was unfortunately Monday in Washington, D.C., and could not, I'm not sure I've been here or there, but could not be here for the hearing. We have been alarmed in the past by what we call dumbing down of the standards, and there are some communities, unfortunately, that we have no trust in, and this at least presents an opportunity for the department to develop an equivalency approach, and the department to then be responsible for the kind of person in terms of their experience and background to take this. This does not, in my opinion, impact ORS 479, the electrical law, as it relates to A-level instructors. I'll be talking to you at great length about Senate Bill 1239 later on, which we consider very dangerous. But Senate Bill 785, I think, with the amendments, is better. I'm still concerned about the standard, but I think that to some extent the director department has the authority under administrative rule to do those things already. Basically.
You're, by and large, in support of this bill. That's semi-neutral.
I'll just say that the four of our four groups that I mentioned are in opposition to it, but we must agree that the amendments make it more palatable. So we'll reserve the right to continue to oppose it in the House.
John, it sounded like the opposition and our concern was a concern that there would be different standards if each of the municipalities were doing it themselves. If I interpreted what Joe answered previously to my question, this is really going to be a decision that his agency is going to make since we're issuing the certification. Does that make you feel any better?
Mr. Chair, through the chair, through Senator Bryan. Yes, as I said, I feel better about with the amendments because it allows a uniform standard throughout the state. We have great difficulty in terms of clear interpretation, in terms of quality of the individual that we deal with local government. And this, to me, is another area to, as we call it, dumbing down the quality and the ability of the individual. Kind of like letting a law clerk do neurosurgery or something of that nature, but hopefully if you let the department stays with the department, that's stronger.
My assumption has always been that I guess municipalities can hire whoever they want. That's certainly their prerogative, but with respect to carrying out the responsibilities for review and inspections under the Uniform Building Code, the people who do that for the municipalities have to be certified by the state agency.
Yes, so as amended, that's what this would say, too. Sorry. I'll withdraw a portion of my earlier strong concern and just say that we're not real comfortable with it, but I think if it were to stay in this form in the House side and the proponents would commit to doing that, then perhaps they'd have a bill that one could at least stomach.
Is there anybody else in the audience who wants to testify on 785? You've got a little criticism in the Oregonian for not allowing citizen participation.
Not this committee.
This committee allows a lot of participation. Well, we've got a list calling this. Okay, so...
I'll move the dash one amendments.
Okay, we're going to the other one. The dash one amendments to Senate Bill 785 removed by Senator Metzger. Any comments, objections, so ordered? Chair will move Senate Bill 785 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Any comments? Any objections? So ordered. Carrier. Oh, yeah,
building buyer.
They made a building code buyer. Okay, we'll open up a work session on Senate Bill 1239. Okay, John, let's say John, you said you're going to have some opposition to that, so we need, who else do we need up here then? Potential. Okay, you like to find the dash one, Sherry?
Yes. This bill proposes to direct CCDS to adopt rules which would allow the one and two family dwelling code inspectors to conduct an electrical and plumbing inspection. During the public hearing on April 26th, you heard about a comparison, how the requirements of the one- and two-family dwelling code inspectors' qualifications differ from those of electrical and plumbing inspectors. There were some discussions about the pay scales of journey level plumber and electrician and that of the specialty code inspectors. There were discussions of the content of the written examination for these inspectors. And the amendment does a couple of things. In the bill, the original bill requires director of DCBS by rule to provide for a person certified under ORS 455622, which is people certified to do the 1-2 family dwelling code inspection, to serve as plumbing inspectors and then as electrical inspectors. The amendment changes that language, deletes the sentence that is in bold in your bill, and replaces it with this sentence that says the director by rule shall establish training and examination standards that allow a person certified under ORS 455622 to obtain A-level plumbing inspector certification. So the emphasis before was requiring DCBS to let people who are currently certified to do one thing to do something else. And this amendment now says people who are certified to do one thing will be put into or could benefit from training and examination standards that DCBS would establish by rule that would eventually allow them to obtain either the plumbing inspector certification or the electrical inspector certification. There is one issue related to Senate Bill 1239, which we would not, the committee would not have time to address if you choose to move the bill out, and that is related to a fiscal impact. In the amendment now, we're asking, well, we're directing DCBS to establish training and examination standards. So as they establish the standards, they need to provide for something in order for people interested currently certified to do one thing to gain higher levels of skills and then be able to do this other work of electrical and plumbing inspection. And we simply do not have the time, given the short, the very quick turnaround with the amendment, we need to figure out what is the cost and how is that going to be carried out. You could choose to bring this bill, if you choose to pass it, two ways and means, so that the fiscal impact could be sorted out there before it goes to the floor and to the other chamber.
Sorry about
that. Question, Sherry, isn't establishing standards included with the bill, because that's sort of the normal process that the agency does anyway. Why is there an additional fiscal impact?
Chairman, members of the committee, again for the record, my name is Joe Brewer. I was operating last evening, interacting with Ms. Shunk at somewhat of a disadvantage. I don't have a copy of the amendment. I have seen a copy, but I don't have a copy. So my understanding was that we would not only be establishing those standards, but there'd also be a process for training and examination, so that we would expect to have an impact. Thank you. From the standpoint of the training line item in our budget, that I believe would need to be increased so that there'd be sufficient funds to contract with training providers and to train these individuals. And there may also be an impact from the standpoint of staffing. As I pointed out to Ms. Shum, that we get a number of these things every session where there are 0.2 or 0.3 FTE, and as someone once said, a million here, it adds up to real money. So we push a couple of these things together. Before you know it, we have an FTE or two that we really don't have provided for. So our staff hasn't had a chance to evaluate that. We just wanted to go on record as saying that we need to take a close look at that. This would be a serious move, providing a path from one and two families to A-level plumbing and electrical. That's something that's a vast departure from standards we've had in the past in terms of experience and qualification requirements to do that. So we want to make sure that we did a very good job of putting that program together. With that, I'd be happy to take any questions.
This is provided training path.
Mm-hmm.
So, the vision that. So, we're basically talking to the basic code inspectors now, the electricians, and allowing them to go to a lower standard, or an entry standard for electrical or plumbing in a few places here?
Chairman, Senator Beyer, my understanding is that the intent of the bill is to provide a training and examination path for an individual who's currently certified as a 1 and 2 family dwelling inspector. We have 3 levels of certification, 1 and 2 family dwelling, D level, which is light commercial, small commercial work, and A level, which is hospitals, high-rises, industrial facilities. This would provide a path from 1 and 2 family dwelling to A level, and I believe our certification requirements are significantly different in those two categories, and certainly the experience requirements are significantly different. It's a much more demanding exercise to inspect an industrial plant or hospital than it is to inspect a 1,500 square foot home.
So this is someone who's just basically, the concept of someone who's basically doing structural inspections now and allowing them to cross train and go all the way up to the highest level of electrical and plumbing?
The chair, the Senator Beyer, that's my understanding.
Ooh, that's a big jump.
Mr. Chair?
Let's go down the line. And,
okay. Mr. Chair, for the record, my name is Bill Cross, and I'm with the Oregon Building Officials Association. The intent of the amendment is to provide a means by which if you're a 1 and 2 family dwelling inspector certified as plumbing or electrical, that you could then participate in a training program that would allow you to prepare for an examination to become an A-level electrical or plumbing inspector. Currently, there's not a path to do that if you're in state and you're an inspector and you're not, for example, a supervising electrician or you're not a journeyman plumber. We need to find a means by which, and we're not suggesting here, in fact, the proposal would allow the director to establish standards for the training and examination, and we would anticipate that those standards would be obviously very rigorous because of the different requirements in inspecting 1 and 2 family A level. But at least it would be a path that you could pursue, which currently doesn't exist.
Bill, so I guess what you're trying to get it clear in my mind, it takes a number of years under an apprenticeship to become a licensed electrician or a licensed plumber. And sort of the mental concept that we have now is that before you can inspect the work, you probably had to do it. And this would replace that with the concept that if you've taken some training, you might be able to inspect the work of a journeyman electrician or a plumber and decide whether they did the job correctly or not.
Mr. Chair, Senator Barr, that's correct. It would allow the inspector to see if they've done the job according to code.
John.
Mr. Chair, for the record, my name is John Gervais, representing the National Electrical Contractors Association, also expressing strong objections to the bill, Senate Bill 1239, on behalf of the International Brotherhood of Electrical Workers and the Plumbing Contractors Associations, and also Local 290 of the Plumbers Union. We see this as one of the most dangerous bills in this session and one of the most objectionable we'll encounter. I understand some of people's concerns, but we have made provisions just last session for different paths and lower paths for people to do inspection. The one and two family inspector, as far as we're concerned, is a person that basically has maybe taken a few courses in community college or some other pathway and passed the national test, which we consider to be absolutely insufficient. But it's allowed. It's been in law since 1979. The coursework is even lower now than it was in 1979. Last session, responding to, because we're in the highest construction period in the history of the state, and responding to some difficulty of cities and counties and local governments, or I mean the state of Oregon, finding applicants for inspectors, we chose to give some ground and allow, instead of a supervising electrician, we went down to a journeyman electrician with 2 years' experience in the field. I think the person's gone through the apprenticeship program and then been in the field for a couple of years, and then they can pass the supervisor's test, which means they have the knowledge of all the codes and all the requirements for installation. Then they can basically become an inspector. That taking the supervisor's test is not for purposes of becoming a supervising electrician, nor can they use it for that. We feel that this kind of inspector proposed, as I see it, it'd be like having a clerical person in a law office being able to go to community college and take a few classes and then challenge the state bar. We know from our experience with the inspectors in one and two family that our contractors can outsmart them, our electricians can outsmart them. We want somebody out there that knows what's happened, that's been involved in it, knows what to look for, hasn't just read it out of a book, but's been in the field. And it's a safeguard both for the contractor in terms of the correct installation, and it's a safeguard for the public. And we feel that this kind of approach would drop the standards to a point we would almost suggest you forget the permits and forget the inspection period, because we think this would be just absolutely insufficient, and I couldn't ask my people to even buy a permit to do this kind of thing, in that they wouldn't receive an inspection that amounted to anything as far as I'm concerned. I don't know if I can say any stronger than that. Again, this is one of, I think, the most dangerous bills we've encountered this session for the safety of the people of the state of Oregon in plumbing and electrical.
Do you have any comments?
Again, for the record, my name is Joe Brewer. I find myself in the dubious position of, I think, having to add something to what Mr. Gervais said. That we also, last session, created a path for out-of-state inspectors to come in and qualify as electrical inspectors in our state. In the past, that was not the case. You literally had to be homegrown, home-trained in order to be an inspector. I would also point out, and it may not be the proponent's intent, I haven't checked ORS 455622, but I believe, as written, this amendment would allow structural inspectors who are working, inspecting framing and homes, so forth and so on, to be trained and become electrical and plumbing inspectors at the A level. And I think that's really a policy statement for the policy decision for the committee. Does the committee, does the membership want to do away with experience requirements, do away with the requirement to be a journey level worker in these areas before you can be an inspector, and move to a training and examination path from the one and two family dwelling level? That's the policy question.
So currently, can field inspectors do the electrical and plumbing on one and two family dwellings?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Beyer, currently, as of last session, again, there was a path created for a one- and two-family dwelling inspector, say a structural inspector, to become certified as a one- and two-family electrical and plumbing inspector through a training course administered by their own building official. And that did not exist before, and in fact, we've availed ourselves of that and sent a few of our inspectors to training in the city of Portland to become cross-certified either in the electrical or plumbing area. But again, that's at the one- and two-family dwelling level, not at the A level.
So we have that now.
Through the chair again to Senator Barr. Yes, we do.
And when we've heard discussions, in fact, from you about where the problem is finding people, in fact, I think it came up across training with the small cities. It's predominantly in the rural areas.
Chairman, Senator Beyer, I have heard anecdotally that jurisdictions have trouble finding inspectors. And Mr. Cross and I have discussed at some length trying to find some way to quantify that and determine exactly how many vacant inspector positions there are out there, because again, the division is not experiencing that difficulty.
At a lower level of pay, they're not experiencing that difficulty.
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, Senator Byer, again, we pay perhaps the lowest, except perhaps the very smallest jurisdictions in the state. So
you could make that same claim for the state, for local governments, in terms of finding engineers. Now, too, whenever the economy's hot, you can't pay them enough. The competition by the sector's too high. It's just the cost of business.
Mr. Chair, and back to Senator Byer, there are the last three or four years that I've been involved with the Oregon building officials, a number of jurisdictions that have had open positions for extended periods of time could not find qualified individuals who either met the certification criteria or who, in their opinion, were qualified to do the job. I mean, they may have met certification, but didn't want what they would consider qualified for what they wanted a person to do. Part of our problem has been that in the state, it's very difficult to get a person who's currently involved or employed in the trades to leave a well-paid job for a city or county, and it's extremely difficult to attract those individuals. So we have experienced from large jurisdictions, Washington County, to small jurisdictions. I mean, it's run the gamut, and I can only attest to the fact that there ought to be a way in which we could take individuals who've got experience now doing one family dwelling electrical or plumbing, or once they come from structural mechanical and get trained in one and two family electrical or plumbing, that they can then progress to the next level. And it may take years. I mean, we're not envisioning a turnaround training program where they go to a Chemeketa or a community college for a semester or take a couple classes. We're talking about an extended training program that would allow them to meet the standards approved by the Building Codes Division and pass an examination. But at least it would be an opportunity for people that do have inspection experience to move into some definite needs that we have at the A level.
Mr. Chair, for the record, John Gervain. The Director of Building Codes, Administrator of the Building Codes Division, testified that being the lowest paying inspection authority in the state of Oregon, they have applicants, and I've heard at least one or two a month. I've talked to some other jurisdictions, and they pay quite a bit more than the state of Oregon, and they have applicants also. We have gone, of course, through the highest construction period in the history of the state. We initially were going to remain high in some respects, I guess. I don't like all the traffic I'm experiencing and all the congestion issue, other things, but we're not in that anymore, and we're going down, in fact, and that's documentable. And I just don't feel comfortable with sacrificing. I know that other states do it differently. We're considered the best in the United States, and there's a reason for that. And I think we care more than some other people, and I think we have stronger people. A one and two family, or one and two, and they'd like to have it, a triple-headed inspector. The building officials use have a little bit of knowledge in electrical, a little bit of knowledge in plumbing, a little bit of knowledge here. No practical experience required, and they have it, but they don't have it required. And we just can't too strongly oppose this concept.
Questions on this now?
One.
Yes,
Joe, on the amendment that you have in front of you, it seems like that possibly could give you broad authority in determining what training would be. And, in your opinion, would that amendment allow you to make those conditions as strict as you felt was necessary to provide proper A-level inspectors?
through the chair to Senator Metzger. Yes, Senator, that's why I indicated there would likely be a fiscal impact as a result of this step, and that's why I characterized the policy decision for this committee as being a decision about moving away from that experience requirement, moving away from that journey-level worker requirement to a place where training and an examination path could serve as an equivalent. And absolutely, I've worked in the electrical industry in Oregon since 1976 before going into public service. I would envision these requirements being very stringent. And with that, I suppose it would be, bring more contention and more angst to the whole building codes arena. So I have mixed emotions about the concept.
But what you're saying is, as I read you, is that the public policy question is whether we want to state in terms of helping to fund that as opposed to the current system and funding that level of expertise.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Metzger, I hadn't thought of it in those terms, but I suppose that's exactly the question, because we currently have signatory and independent contractors and labor organizations providing a high level of training to individuals to become skilled in these areas so that they can eventually become inspectors if they choose to work, continue to work in the field. We would be supplanting that with a state-funded training activity.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
30 seconds.
While, Mr. Chair, to the question, while the director or the administrator of the Building Codes Division has the authority to go as high as necessary, we don't know who will be the administrator in the future. They have the authority to go as low as they want to. And we're deeply concerned. That's why, in just above the dark language on page 2, we put into the statute things that we ask for. And we have, you know, we feel, given lots of ground. And when you're talking about somebody in a hospital or a high-tech building with clean rooms and things like that, you need somebody that can't be outsmarted.
Thank you very much, gentlemen. There's anybody else in the audience who wants to testify? I think you folks have been here for a while. James, anybody? You folks?
Good afternoon. I'm Jane Cummins for the League of Oregon Cities, and I will be brief. I, too, have heard over a period of years the problems that local jurisdictions have in getting people when they put out RFPs. This has not been something just in the last year or two. It has been, I would say, over the last 3, 4, 5, 6 years that I have been involved in this area. And I think what I've heard people say is that, yes, there have been some changes and some flexibility over the last few sessions, but let's look long-term in the state. Let's look at some ways of creating some paths that don't sacrifice safety, but also allow for some of the folks who get into the field to have something, you know, to train for, to strive for. So I think I've heard it from two sides. I've heard it from city managers and building officials saying, you know, we'd like to, over a long term, figure out a way to provide an adequate pool of personnel. And then I've heard some of the people who have said, at the lower level that are in state, that they would like to have a career path. Now, they have not said that they would like to go in for a 6-month training program and then all of a sudden go into a high rise. And I think you heard the panelists up here before say that, yes, there would be stringent standards. And we're supportive of developing a path for that the state can provide, albeit a long path, but to provide a path and leap and think long term for Oregon.
Jane, did you expect them or something like that, that someone following that training path would be expected to have the same level of training that someone who was training to be a journeyman electrician would have?
Mr. Chair, Senator Beyer, what I've heard from people coming from other states who have been in the field 10, 15, 20 years is that Oregon has unique certification requirements, and some of them, having done some inspection work in other states, feel that they have been qualified to do the work there, and they feel that they are qualified to at least take an exam in Oregon, but they cannot. They tell me also that they feel that there are, like I said, in other states, the experience has not been that buildings have been falling down or that there have been electrical fires or, you know, pipes bursting. But it, in no way do we mean to shortchange the training or the time period. We're not, as I say, suggesting that somebody turn right around to be able to do something else. This may be an area where part of the long period of time is, you know, there's a provisional, or that you can only do, there may be some parts that are excluded. Some of the high tech or some of the most involved, I doubt if some of the A-level who have been working in some smaller communities could handle that without some assistance. So I think there's a variety of ways to look at it, but I do think that if you look long term and look at the ups and downs of construction, do we want to develop various ways for people to develop a career? And the folks that get into this would like to have career advancement. And we could use the help.
It's more complicated than telecommunication.
Chairman, I beg your indulgence, Joe Brewer, for the record again. I just heard a word that I want to go on record as saying, certainly I would recommend the agency had nothing to do with and was part of our concerns with some work done by the certification task group. That's the concept of provisional certification. We have a situation in our state currently where I believe, I'm going from memory now, that 10% of the jurisdictions in the state are using folks that are not certified in their required area to do particular inspections. Provisional certifications is an administrative nightmare and would put the division, the agency, in a position of having to take administrative action against jurisdictions, municipalities. We don't want to go there. So my sense is if such a path were created, it would be take the course, pass the exam, and you become that. Not an incremental provisional sort of thing. That's a long, torturous kind of situation. Chair.
Yes.
Assuming we went this route and you were providing us training functions, is it possible it might be fee funded, fee supported?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Starr, I believe that certainly the majority of it would need to be supported. And when you say providing this training, it would be difficult, I believe, for the agency or for the state to provide this kind of training. I think we'd have to look to the very same sources that are providing it now to provide it in this case. And I'm sure there would be substantial fees for this kind of training.
Thank you. Any comments from the committee as to what we have a potential
I understand the problem. I mean, it was a good step going in the alley for the cost standard for residential homes and families. I'm a little hesitant to take the step to the higher level commercial industrial. It may be an issue. I don't think we're going to go over today or probably in the session, but maybe this is a reasonably good subject to take a look at over the interim and ask the building officials and the trades to work with us and explore what other states do. Maybe there's an answer out there. I'm not comfortable with that.
Yeah.
You know,
so. I share. I'm not comfortable with that, Mr. Chairman.
We'll all attempt to work again at this point. I think we should put the admonition out that, you know, to have a work group maybe set up for some of the interim and try and work this thing out because it is. You can tell there's a lot of angst between people, and obviously there's a problem, and how we're going to resolve it. Doesn't look like that we're going to be able to move all this committee today, so we'll get to the work session. And I guess one other thing in the committee, that when Senator Byer was a guy, we did assign you to carry two bills. I don't recall exactly what they were, but
a good committee minister will help me.
You're going to hear it more. You're a field of
close in hand when we're on the floor.